I'm pleased to announce that we have a bar admission ceremony this morning. And at this time, the court recognizes Mr. Robert Monahan for a motion.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and members of the court. May it please the court, I move admission of Hillary R. Berger of the District of Columbia, Jonathan Durazio of New York, Sandon X. Fernandez of Texas, Abram M. Finley of the District of Columbia, Devin Humphreys of Indiana, Daniel A. Mirabelli of New York, Michael Nonchinant of New Jersey, Teresa M. Persico of New York, and Aiden Yamada of Texas. I've examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I'm satisfied that they possess qualifications for membership of the bar of this court.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and legal acumen. Accordingly, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Mr. Monahan, your motion is granted. And Mr. Squires, please administer the oath. Counsel, I would like to welcome you to the bar of this court. In doing so, I think it's appropriate for me to recite the words that are engraved over the entrance of the University of Virginia School of Law, which both Judge Johnson and I attended. Those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to welcome you to the bar of this court. So congratulations, and you may be seated. Mr. Squires, do we have any other business before the court prior to the oral argument? Very well then, we shall proceed. Captain Moore, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Schaefer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The military judge committed error when he ignored the Constitution, the rules for court-martial, and Supreme Court precedent when he totally closed appellant's court-martial for an MRE 412 hearing without conducting any analysis or putting any findings on the record. He did so in violation of Waller and RCM 806, and he did so over appellant's objection. As this court has noted in Hassan, this is a structural error, and the remedy here for either a violation of 806 or the Constitution is a new 412 hearing.
Counsel, I'd like to explore that issue with you for a moment. Now, when we look at what the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts did in Jones, they made it clear that the proper approach, that case was in a different posture, but they explained that for those cases that were still on direct appeal, where there was a closed hearing, that the proper step would be for the trial court to apply the Waller factors to the circumstances that were existing at the time of the closed hearing, and then determine whether the hearing should have been open or not. If it should have been a closed hearing, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts essentially said, no harm, no foul. Now, in your brief, you jump immediately to a new MRE 412 hearing. Could you please explore that?
Yeah, sure. That's consistent with the Supreme Court's ruling in Waller, where the hearing can be separated out from the trial itself. The Supreme Court in Waller said to send it back to the beginning of the suppression hearing in Waller to determine what portions of the suppression hearing could remain open and what required to be closed. The remedy didn't stop there, though. The remedy was for the structure or for the entire hearing to proceed, which should be the correct remedy here. under this
court. So do you disagree with this concept of if, after applying the Waller factors, this hearing should have been closed, that there's essentially a no harm, no foul principle that applies?
Your Honor, I do not agree with that. I agree that the remedy would be to continue on with the entire hearing, that the analysis does not stop with just the open and close due to the fact that this is a structural error.
But where are you getting that from? You cite to footnote 15 in Hassan, but Hassan is talking about in that footnote that 806 remedy would be the same as constitutionally required under Waller. And in Waller, the Supreme Court says, hey, it's not a situation where a defendant in that situation would get a complete do-over. It says a violation, talking about a violation of public trial guarantee, says the remedy should be appropriate to the violation. So why not simply first, as the first step, have the military judge determine, after applying the Waller factors, that whether it should have been a closed or an open hearing?
I believe that would be the first step, Your Honor.
So in your brief, when you jump immediately to a new MRE 412 hearing, you are simply leaving out that first step?
The first step is for the 412 hearing, in, before any closure, it's appellant's position that the analysis has to be done. That was the judge's error here, is by not doing the analysis. So under either the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment right, or under 806b4, prior to any closure, the analysis has to be done.
Granted, but I'm asking about the relief in this particular case. So you're saying that the first thing that should happen is the military judge, in this case, should determine, after applying the Waller factors, whether it should be open and closed. And if the military judge says closed, no harm, no foul, the conviction stands.
After conducting the analysis, if it's still determined to be closed, the hearing still needs to be done anew, the 412 hearing itself. If there's a material
change. Why is that?
That's how I read Waller, Your Honor, is that the hearing does not end on the decision. The material change in that hearing is not whether it's open or not. The material change for this case in a 412 hearing would be that the evidence that is under review in that hearing, whether it is admitted. In this case, the evidence did not come in. The military judge found it was not admissible. So the material change which would trigger the new hearing in this case would be for the entire 412 hearing to be conducted, for the judge to then rule on it. And then if the material change is that he finds that the evidence is admitted, then that would trigger the rehearing. If there's no material change in the entire 412 process, that if the judge, after conducting the analysis, after conducting the entire new hearing, with that structural error and puts the appellant back to his right of having a properly conducted hearing after having the constitutional analysis applied prior to his closure, if there's a material change after that, then that would trigger the rehearing.
So you don't agree with the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts and Jones?
I agree with most of the – I think the Supreme Court in Jones their entire analysis, since that they sent that back for the separate reason of the DNA reason. I don't know if the entire was fleshed out, but I think the reasoning in Waller is the way I read Waller, the Supreme Court reasoning in Waller, which this court should apply, is that the analysis does not end just at the hearing. That the way I read Waller is that it's the hearing is done anew based off the structural error. And the material change would be with the evidence, not just based off of at the closure. Because with the structural error, and similar to in Ortiz, where it was he got an entire new trial, this court should follow that in light of Hassan, that maybe the entire new trial is not the proper remedy, but the proper remedy is an entire new 412 hearing, Your Honor.
Counsel, may I ask you two questions? First, could you comment on the amicus position that if 806 and 412 are in conflict, that 806 should control because it was promulgated by the President after 412 was promulgated?
I agree with the Air Force amicus and Mr. Sullivan's analysis in that. We also hit that note in our opening brief, Your Honor, that in 2004, when the President explicitly took out the language that except as otherwise provided in the manual, that puts the 412C2 in conflict with what came after that.
And what do we do about the fact that the President repromulgated all of the rules of evidence, say in 2012, I believe, without making any changes to 412? Is that significant?
Your Honor, the fact that the both rules remain in conflict and that no court has ruled in on this conflict, it needs to be addressed. And
well, what I'm really saying, though, is that if you look at the President's executive orders, the President has repromulgated all of the military rules of evidence without changing 412, but it actually did come after the amendments on 806, or at least at the same time when other things were repromulgated. I mean, can we really say that it came afterwards when there's, in other words, the executive orders did not always just say, change this paragraph, change that paragraph. For example, in 2012, they just reissued all of the rules of evidence and they didn't change anything. Does that count as a new enactment?
Well, Judge Maddox, can I do a friendly amendment
sure.
to your question? To kind of reframe it, in light of Judge Maggs's point, because that was the question I was going to ask, with the 2012 promulgation, then would we go to another canon of statutory interpretation that the more specific overrides the more general? And in this case, the more specific would be 412 versus the more general 806. Does that help in kind of reframing that question?
I don't believe the more specific is 412. I would say that reading the rules together, 806, which also says, except as otherwise provided in this rule, which when they remove the language of except as otherwise provided in the manual, that doesn't cure anything. So you still have to read 806, and we still have that conflict of both rules we have the conflict of shall be closed versus except as otherwise provided in this rule, conduct the constitutional analysis, balance the overriding governmental interest with, and then we can put in the guardrails of, is there some sort of limitations we can put on the closure? Is there to kind of balance the Sixth Amendment right with whatever the interest is, presumably a privacy interest of the victim in a case, but in this case, we don't even know what the interest was.
Counsel, on that point, is there some way to reconcile 806 and 412? You know, if you look at 806, the first factor is the compelling interest, and maybe the President has already decided that, and it's just really no longer up for debate, that there is a compelling interest. So that one's going to be satisfied in all 412-type cases. And then the other three factors in 806 seem to be more case-specific, but a lot of that comes back in 412. In 412, of course, the military judge has to tailor the closure and so forth. Is it possible to reconcile the two in that way?
I think the way to reconcile them, Your Honor, is to follow 806 before do the analysis, because not in all 412 cases, there may not be that compelling interest. For instance, in this case, where the defense was not looking to seek for any intimate details. They specifically said that. They were more interested in the mindset at the time of the report. It wasn't about intimate details of what the closure was for. This could have been done without providing any intimate details versus so there would be no privacy interest at stake. Or in another situation, Your Honor, could be that if the evidence was already admitted in a 412 hearing, the victim testified to it in open court, and then for whatever reason, that case got flipped on appeal, goes back to a rehearing, All of that's already been in open court. So, again, that privacy interest would be diminished in that case, where after conducting the 806b4 analysis, the Sixth Amendment right may prevail in that case. It's not a closure in every case. In many cases, I would say 412 would still remain closed.
Counsel, let me also ask you a question about a footnote that you had in your opening brief, which is that maybe this isn't even really a 412 case at all, that 412 doesn't apply in this situation, which involved non-consensual activity. Is it your position that 412 does apply in this case, but we'd still have to use the 806 factors? Or, I mean, maybe this is not really the appropriate case to decide a big question about 412 if 412 isn't really applicable in this case.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. This is a case to decide public trial. The reference to that was with Erickson, the footnote 2 in Erickson of this closure, did it even need to happen? So some of these claims were already reported with the hopes of a trial. So there's also support that once something is reported, then, again, that privacy interest would be diminished. So taking into all of those factors into account, that's for the military judge to decide on a case-by-case basis, which this isn't an overburden on the trial itself to balance these very important fundamental rights of public trial and privacy interests of victims. This can be done case by case, and the mandated closure in 412 would fall into unconstitutional globe, Your Honor.
Counsel, there are other places in the rules that authorize in-camera review, right? Would your logic extend to those situations, too? Do we need military judges to go through an 806 analysis before they can perform in-camera review when that's authorized under the rules of evidence?
Depending on the situation. If it's 513, I think a clear reading of 806 would, after the in-camera, if it's going to go into the hearing phase of that, then 806 would require prior to closure, if they're going to be calling the witnesses, would require that analysis, Your Honor.
What's with the discovery dispute about documents and the military judge finally decides, oh, I'm going to review all these, or sometimes the rules require them. I'm going to go back, I'm going to rule all these, I'm going to make decisions about admissibility. And sometimes those documents haven't gone to the defense, they haven't gone to all the parties. Do we need to invoke the 806 before they can engage in that kind of analysis? Or is it permissible for the President of the Rules to say, sometimes we do things not in front of the panel?
I think that's permissible, Your Honor. I would agree with that. In certain tailored situations, it is permissible. But once we're, like, similar to a 412 hearing, if this Court rules under 806 and not the Constitution, that's going to put more latitude into when the specific analysis is required. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And what is the best argument? Like, I don't think it's a totally settled question whether or not 412 hearings are part of the public trial to which the public has a right. So what is the best argument to say that these aren't ancillary, you know, hearings where we're just deciding about admissibility, so we'll find out whether this evidence gets to be part of the public trial? No, they are part of the public trial itself. What's your best argument to say, yes, absolutely, they're part of the public trial?
The Massachusetts Supreme Court argument in Jones that these are not routine administrative matters. These are going to the crux of the issue, especially in matters with consent, that when we are calling witnesses, we're putting them under oath, we are cross-examining them. The counsel are then offering argument, and then the military judge is then issuing rulings. As the Supreme Court of Massachusetts said in Jones, that since these are not routine administrative matters, that the Constitution assessing the Waller values would apply, Your Honor.
Which of those specific, you know, Waller announces those four sort of considerations, and which of those do you think is most at play here? Because at the hearing, everything that is deemed admissible will then be part of the rest of the trial, right? So why not, you know, the courts that have gone the other way have said, well, none of this we can decide these things not in front of the panel because whatever the jury, because whatever is going to be admissible will eventually be in front of the jury or the panel. So why are those courts that have gone the other way? Why did they get that wrong?
Here, in this case, Your Honor, I think the most important value for this case specific would be the discouraging perjury based off of the facts of this case. But again, case by case, assessing the values for each case could go either way.
I see your time has expired. Any further questions?
Chief Judge, I have a question, but counsel can come back on rebuttal.
That's fine.
I'd like to revisit, if I may, your discussion with the Chief Judge on the remedy. And I guess I thought that the whole reasons undergirding the right to an open trial is to protect the accused, in other words, allow him to, or her, to have the public view the proceeding against him to ensure fairness and what have you, and the public's right to come in and see how the system works. Now, you seem to be arguing that on the remedy, if we agree with you, that there should not only be a reanalysis, an analysis of the decision to close or open the proceeding, but that the actual merits of what's being determined in the 412 hearing ought to be revisited. Is that, am I wrong? I've been wrong before, but I'm asking if I am now.
That's correct, Your Honor. So for the right to the open trial is not absolute, as the Supreme Court has said time and time again. So the hearing itself, after the analysis, if the judge determines that based off the facts of this case-specific, case-by-case analysis still needs to remain closed, then there are situations where the public would be excluded, Your Honor.
No, I understand that, but I guess I don't understand why the decision or analysis to open or close a hearing, what impact that has on the judge's ultimate substantive determination in the 412 hearing itself. In other words, if we send it back and say, hey, look, the military judge needs to do an analysis on whether he should have closed the hearing or not, he does that. You're saying that now that he's done that, he should be reanalyzing everything that took place in the closed hearing. And my question is, what would change? Why would the decision to, on the part of the military judge, either open it or close the hearing, why would that change his analysis, absent some new evidence or something like that, once he makes his decision to open or close the hearing?
Your Honor, with the structure, it's hard to say what would change in this case.
But counsel, if the military judge goes through the 806 analysis and determines it remains closed, where then is the structural error? That's I'm with Judge Sparks on that one. I'm missing that if the analysis is conducted and he makes or she makes a decision that it will remain, that it will be closed, then where is the structural error at that point?
The structural error is not conducting the analysis at all.
Yeah, but I'm saying if he's conducted the analysis, then there's no – that's vitiated any potential structural error. I mean, it's been cured.
In a different case where a judge actually puts his findings on the records and we have the opportunity to review this for an abuse of discretion, the analysis would certainly be different. Since the judge put nothing on the record in this case, it's – a structural error where we don't know even why he closed.
Yes, but Judge Sparks's scenario was, if we were to remand it and say, military judge, you must conduct the 806 analysis, and the military judge says, va bene, and actually does it, then there is no longer a structural error. He would have or she would have done the 806 or the constitutionally required analysis to make that determination. So once that determination is made, then does a structural error still exist?
Yes, Your Honor, because I would go to Ortiz that we can't ad hoc just recreate the findings. It's the hearing itself that needs to be done anew. So regardless of what what happened with the new analysis at the new 412 hearing. The entire, in Ortiz, it was an entire new trial. Here it would be an entire new 412 hearing, because we can't just recreate the closure. It's the entire process, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Moore. Captain Schaefer.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Nicholas Schaefer, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States. Just briefly addressing a couple of the questions that were posed to appellant. If it is found that a remedy is needed, it is true that the remedy should be appropriate to the violation. And so the government's position would be it is first an individualized Waller analysis that would be conducted if that is found to be the appropriate remedy, and then only if there is a need for an open hearing should there be an additional hearing. In addition, just addressing briefly Judge Maggs and Judge Johnson's questions about the conflict for 806, because lex specialis, or the specialized rule, would take precedence over the generalized rule, there is no conflict here. The general rule is a presumption of openness in RCM 806. However, 412 is much more specific for a much more narrow subset of information and a narrow subset of cases. And therefore, there is no conflict that requires any change in the application of those laws. In terms of the way that the RCM was changed in 2002 or after 2002, so the language previously was a session may be closed over the objection of the accused only when expressly authorized by another provision of this manual. The fact that that was deleted is because it was superfluous language, and that was not now the only way to close a hearing. So it is that language only, not just the language of when, that is important here. Members of the court, Military Rule of Evidence 412 requires closed hearings. This is the only reasonable reading of subsection C2. But this does not create a constitutional or statutory problem. The Sixth Amendment public trial right does not attach to these limited hearings. The President has mandated closed hearings to address a compelling interest in a narrowly tailored way, and RCM 806 does not conflict. Therefore, the military judge did not abuse his discretion, and this court should affirm. Now, turning to that initial issue that, Judge Hardy, you raised when the appellant was arguing, the Supreme Court has only extended the public trial right under the Sixth Amendment in two instances beyond the trial on the merits, and that is in Waller v. Georgia for suppression hearings and in Presley v. Georgia for jury voir dire. What we have here instead in MRE 412 is a rule patterned off the Federal Rules of Evidence 412, very closely related based on Article 36 of the UCMJ and based on the unique military environment, the needs for this rule as well. And since 1978 in the federal system, there has been a tradition of mandatory closure. Now, their language is slightly different, but the drafter's analysis of the MRE addresses this. An in-camera hearing federally is nearly synonymous with our closed hearing in the military setting.
Counsel, what, if any, effect or impact does the fact that 412 is an exclusionary rule, so that the accused / appellant must come in and prove why this evidence should come in, as opposed to some of the other scenarios, as you said, with Waller being a suppression hearing, does the validity of 412 or the constitutionality of 412 hinge on that fact that it's an exclusionary rule, so this evidence would presumptively not come in And so it's more akin to an offer or proffer of proof?
I think largely yes, Your Honor. It's not the only factor and the only value that is discussed in Waller that should be appropriate to consider here. However, the fact that this is a rule of general inadmissibility, of presumptive irrelevance, that does distinguish it starkly from a suppression hearing in multiple ways. The Supreme Court found in Waller that those were often case dispositive. And that's not to downplay the importance of 412 and the possibility that this could be a very important issue at trial. However, this is not because of that rule of general inadmissibility. It is not something where it is typically ending the case at that point. Similarly, it is narrow categories of information, other sexual behavior, other sexual predisposition, that is, by definition, outside of the offenses that are charged, outside of the res geste. And so, rather than at a suppression hearing, again, where you are looking at police misconduct potentially, things that the public has a significant interest in scrutinizing, here we have a significant interest, a compelling interest, in ensuring the privacy of a victim is protected. It is not scrutinizing the judge and the prosecutor in the same way. In a very real way, effectively, the victim is on trial at a 412 hearing, as opposed to the trial on the merits, where it is primarily, if not solely, focused on the accused. Here, we have these values that were considered in Waller do not apply with the same weight, or they apply in favor of the government's argument. Yes, Your Honor.
It seems like you're saying it wouldn't matter if we just said 806 applies because it would come out the same way anyway. We'd still have a closed hearing. I mean, isn't that pretty much your position here?
Yes, Your Honor, because even if it's found, even if it's under 806 or if it's found that the public trial right attaches, the President has made this determination, has in effect done the Waller analysis. There is a compelling interest, and that is found throughout even cases like Commonwealth v. Jones. They say we do not dispute that there is a compelling interest in protecting the privacy interest of a victim to ensure
that that's essentially the first factor in the 806 analysis. And what if our court said, look, 806 came after 412, therefore 806 controls. However, looking at that first factor, it would be an unusual case that that wasn't satisfied. Doesn't that just avoid all the constitutional issues and we're still applying 806?
Your Honor, it's because there is a specific process mandated by the President and adopted from Congress and the Federal Rules of Evidence, it is unnecessary to do the 806 analysis.
Well, Counsel, you say that 412 is more specific than 806, which may be true. Counsel for Appellant disagrees. But does the specific controls over the general, does that apply when the general is enacted subsequent to the to the more specific provision? I mean, 806, the language in 806 came after the language in 412.
It did, Your Honor, but for a couple of reasons, one of which was already cited by the Court, the fact that the rules of evidence were repromulgated in its entirety, and there was an opportunity to amend 412 to ensure that that standard was applied to it. Instead, 412, and not just 412, 513, 505, 514, all have these separate procedural requirements, partially because of, you know, for the reasons in 412 that are laid out for the civilian sector. They apply with equal force, protecting against an invasion of privacy and possible embarrassment. But it's also for military efficiency. Our system has an even more compelling interest to have these mandatory closure rules. Because not only does it only apply in a narrow subset of cases, so non-consensual sex offenses, but it only applies to a narrow subset of information, other sexual behavior and other sexual predispositions of a victim.
Well, why doesn't the President just list those as exceptions in 806, kind of like the non-binding discussion does? I mean, that would seem to be the most logical thing to do, and instead the President seems to have taken out that exception. Now, I know you focus on the word only, but, you know, we're confronted with 806 that used to take account of these exceptions, and now that language is gone, and it's just a general rule that says they're going to be open.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it is obviously only persuasive, but that discussion does hearken or reference those specific different procedures. So, and the C also, it comes after a court may, over the objection of the accused, close it in these circumstances. See also these others. I understand it is not binding. It is persuasive. However, it clearly references and it essentially incorporates those different procedures under 806. 806 being the general rule, it does not change the language from only when to never. It is simply, there is a general presumption of openness. When you are closing it to spectators, this is the test that you are generally applying. And then in the discussion, elucidating that a little bit further.
Counsel for Appellant says that 806 is a more specific rule because 806 principle says, the principal provision is hearings will be public. And then it says, except if these factors are met. And that's what makes it more specific. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, similar to the constitutional analysis, trial or court-martial is not going to apply to every single portion. This is not an absolute right. It is a qualified right to a public trial. And so to say that court-martial includes everything from the very beginning of proceedings to the end, that ignores the fact that we have RCM 802 sessions. That ignores the fact that we have, by the definition provided by the appellant, panel deliberations would be included in this definition. And no one is here asserting that panel deliberations need to be preceded by Waller analysis or 806 individualized determinations. While this is the general rule, there are times where it is appropriate for a court to be closed, whether that be based on the tradition of accessibility that we hear about in Press Enterprise 1, or whether public access has a significant positive role in the functioning of that particular process. And in this particular process, there is not a significant positive role.
Counsel, I'm following up on this. You know, the rule 806 says that courts martial shall be open to the public. Is that use of the word courts martial there? Is that broader than what the Constitution defines must be open for public trial purposes in the civilian world? Or are they coterminous? Is 806 broader? The President would certainly have the power to make it as broad. He can make it as broad as he wants, right? He just can't make it narrower than the Constitution demands. Is 806 court-martial and public trial in the civilian world, are they synonymous for these purposes? Or are they not?
Based on the inclusion of those Waller factors, that would tend to support that they are coterminous, that where the right to a public trial attaches, that is what is defined as trial or court-martial for the sake of RCM 806. And so while that is correct, Your Honor, the President certainly has the authority to make it broader, and could have included the specific mandate that this applied to 412. That is not the case. And to read court-martial broader than that would have wide-ranging implications beyond just MRE 412, to include the rules cited before 513, 505, 514. Mandatory closure rules have to be narrowly tailored. So that is an absolute fact. However, this is narrowly tailored, and the narrow subset of offenses again, narrow categories of information. And it's important to cite both for the public trial right attaching and also for this being narrowly tailored. This is more of an offer of proof. The fact-finding determinations that are required for 412 are discussed by this court in U.S. v. Banker. So in applying Military Rule of Evidence 412, the judge is not asked to determine if the proffered evidence is true. It is for the members to weigh the evidence and determine veracity. So this is not a veracity determination generally. This is not a credibility determination. Instead, this is an initial admissibility determination. And so whether it's found that the Sixth Amendment public trial right attaches, if it doesn't, then this is certainly relevant. But also, if it's defining this narrowly tailored, everything that is found admissible will be then subject to open proceedings, minus any sort of 806, you know, analysis that is done for the trial on the merits. This is a very narrow hearing. Also, when compared to the other cases where there have been found to be violations, typically those are the 7 days of a suppression hearing in Waller. You have the 6 weeks of jury voir dire, individual jury voir dire, in Press Enterprise. You have the 41-day preliminary hearing in Press Enterprise 2. Those are the sorts of broad violations that the Supreme Court has typically ruled against. Now, that's not to say a narrow hearing couldn't be violative, but in this situation, that weighs heavily in favor of the government's arguments.
With the application of the Waller factors, to MRE 412 be onerous for the military judge or for the government?
It would not be onerous for the military judge specifically, Your Honor.
Would it be time-consuming?
It would require likely another hearing.
But has Massachusetts, the state courts, have they experienced problems with the application of the Jones decision in that state?
I'm not aware of the specific impacts in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Your Honor. However,
because the compelling interest is patently obvious to anyone right out of the starting blocks. So wouldn't this be a rather, I don't want to say perfunctory, but wouldn't this be a rather easy lift for a court martial?
It may be, Your Honor, in terms of the time or the energy that needs to be expended on it. However, with the determination that was made, and that can be seen in the drafter's analysis, that when the change was made to mandatory closure in 1995 and the current verbiage in 1998, it states that a closed hearing in combination with the sealing requirements fully protects an alleged victim against the invasion of privacy and potential embarrassment, and also talking about the military exigency and the military efficiency that are a part of that compelling interest. So to protect that inherently intimate and sensitive information, to place any of that on the record would be inappropriate. But
you're off on a different...
Yes, Your Honor.
...line of argument there. I'm talking about the burdensomeness of applying the Waller factors. And if a military judge got the decision wrong, wouldn't there be a route of appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. And the government would agree it would not typically be burdensome necessarily. But that is not the question before the court. It says, is this rule violative of the Constitution? Is it violative of RCM 806? And the answer in both of those respects is no. So could the President have promulgated a rule that required this for 412, required this individualized Waller analysis? Absolutely. And it may not have changed our system to an intense degree to, you know. However, based on the determinations that were made by first Congress and the Federal Rules of Evidence and then by the President, they have determined that this is the full protection that is required for this intimate, this sensitive information, and that it is narrowly tailored enough that anything that is admissible will come out. There is still due process within these hearings. There is still appellate review. There is still oaths and cross-examination and counsel being present. It is simply a question of, does the public or does the appellant, does the accused, have a right to have this information broadcast from the outset of this proceeding? Do they have the right to have this broadcast when the judge really doesn't have enough information yet to even understand what the issue is and whether this is admissible when it is already presumed inadmissible?
Captain Schaefer, could I ask you a following hypothetical? And it's not a trick question. I mean, I actually want to know this, how this hypothetical plays out. Suppose the information or evidence at issue or subject to a 412 motion is already in the public sphere. Every newspaper has reported on it. There's been television broadcastings, even on the day of trial, say, under my hypothetical, about this particular incident that's at issue under 412. And the judge says, okay, if I need a 412 closed hearing because the rule says it's mandatory, and I'm going to close it and we're going to talk about this. And the defense says, wait a minute. Why do we need a closed hearing? Because it's already in the public sphere, dramatically so. How does that play out under my hypothetical? Again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No, understood, Your Honor. And just briefly, Your Honor, I see that my time has expired if I may answer.
Please respond to Judge Sparks.
So the compelling interest in the military goes beyond what the compelling interest may be at the civilian level, which is still, you know, extremely compelling. And even if all of this information is publicized, even if this information is out there, that does not change the fact that we have young men and women who are serving together in close quarters, often in isolated areas, and that the military efficiency and the military exigency of ensuring that sexual assaults are reported, ensuring that sexual assault victims are able to come forward and not be dragged through the mud as they were for even large parts of the 20th century and have their chastity at issue. That is still a compelling interest in that case and would still require.
So it's more than just the fact that the information has become public?
It is, Your Honor. And the drafter's analysis lays that out to a certain extent, but it's also just inherent in our military system that the units need cohesion and morale and good order and discipline, and that can be infected and just broken apart by sexual assaults.
So I understand that, but yes, if the information is already in the public sphere, all the military members in the command know about it, what is being protected at that point? Like a mandatory closed hearing?
Well, 2 points on that, Your Honor. One is that it protects the system generally, not just that individual victim. And so it sends a message to other victims, other people who may be uncomfortable when they see this person being put through this, even if everyone already knows about it. And it is a very different thing to be asked these questions in court. That is potentially discouraging further reports of sexual assault. The other thing is it's potentially a slippery slope if we say the more someone's potential, like, other sexual behavior or lack of chastity is known, the more permissible it is for them to be dragged through this in this initial admissibility setting. That would fly in the face of what MRE 412 is intended to protect.
Thank you.
Speaking of what MRE 412 is intended to protect, the appellant raised the issue, and it's one that this court has flagged before, that, like, this may not have even been 412 evidence, right? The evidence they wanted to bring in may not have been 412 evidence. Does the government have any thoughts on that? And if so, like, the answer might be, well, that issue's not really before you, it's not preserved. Well, how do they go about preserving that evidence, right? Like, how do they challenge that determination that this isn't even really something 412 should be dealing with? We should be in a different part of the rules. Does the government have any? Do you want to respond at all to this issue?
Yes, Your Honor. It is somewhat of an open question in terms of allegations of sexual assault, but particularly, you know, true or whether they are proven or not.
And I would agree, Your Honor, that it's not the question before the court. It could be an appellate question at some point to better define what is 412. And that is something that can be challenged. Because that's the factual, that's the sufficient finding that the military judge makes. The military judge, he or she say, this falls under 412, therefore I must close it. And so that is a determination that can be challenged. It was not under, on those grounds in this case. But also, it's important to note that the military judge does not always have all the facts and does not have everything before they make this initial admissibility determination. And so when, especially in this case, defense brings a motion under 412, to a certain extent they're taking them at their word and then they're going to hear it and apply the law to those assumed or proffered facts. And furthermore, while we're not taking a position specifically on whether sexual assaults would be falling under other sexual behavior, other sexual predisposition, it was not an abuse of discretion to believe that in this case. An allegation of sexual assault could, in the fact finder's mind, call into question the victim's sexual imagination or sexual experience. There are ways that it could, to the fact finder, bring up these things that are intended to be protected against. That's not necessarily the case all the time, but that would be an individual challenge to that 412 determination as opposed to attacking the broader rule of mandatory closure.
Any further questions from the bench?
One, Chief. Thank you. In our system, we call this a 412 hearing. In the federal system, FRE 412, it's an in-camera review. Is this form over substance? Meaning, if Congress tomorrow says, okay, we're going to call 412 an in-camera review, would we be still having to have the same constitutional and 806 discussion?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think based on, again, the drafter's analysis specifically saying that this is essentially the equivalent of the federal in-camera review. I'm certainly not an expert in terms of federal civilian practice, but based on the rules are very close to the same. They may use a different term, but it is essentially the same thing. They are still applying those proffered facts to make a, maybe not routine, but a normal evidentiary ruling, something we trust judges to know and apply the law correctly. So.
Captain Schaefer, I'll allow you to briefly conclude.
Very briefly, Your Honor. So the appellant received a public trial, and the narrow closure required by MRE 412 did not change that. So the military judge acted correctly here. Therefore, this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, Captain Schaefer. Captain Moore.
There was discussion about what appellant is entitled to. Appellant is entitled to the case-by-case analysis. Chief Judge, to your question of would this be an onerous process, appellant's position is no, this would not. 412 already requires briefing on the papers. A lot of this could be done briefing on the papers. To the extent it's not, and the military judge, which is he's required to put his analysis on the record, that could be done on the record prior to the closing. So would this be an onerous process? No, Your Honor. To the point of why the new 412 hearing needs to proceed past the analysis, the case-by-case analysis, going to the specific language in Waller, that this, if the same evidence is suppressed, a new trial presumably would be a windfall for – excuse me, wrong one. That evidence not suppressed at the trial or in some other material change would require the new hearing. It's the some other material change, which is why this needs to go further and that it needs to conclude to the end of the 412 hearing. Appellant would offer that in our unique system, that the correct posture of this would be for the CCA to send this to a Dubé. A Dubé judge could conduct a new analysis, determine the closure, conduct a 412 hearing, and then the CCA could make the determination of, is there a material change in this hearing? And then at that point, they can either make the decision to affirm or send it back for a rehearing. Pending questions.
Counsel, can you respond to the government's statement that under your position, an 806 hearing would have to be held before every 802 conference or before the panels deliberate?
I do not take that position, Your Honor. I believe most of that, the 802, I do not think would extend to the 806 analysis has to be done. To Judge Hardy's point about the in-camera, most of that is done on the papers. It's when we're going to be going into what would be perceived as the trial, as the Supreme Court has said in Presley, that Waller applies to the trial.
But 806 says, in courts martial shall be open. Certainly the panel deliberations are part of the court martial.
I do not think that the language of open deliberation, I don't think this would pierce the deliberations.
But see, that's the point that the government's making, which is the specific controls over the general, that in general they're open, but there's specific rules, like the panel will be closed. The panel deliberations will be closed.
I would not support that as with the reading of that, Your Honor. It would be the hearing and the trial itself, not the deliberative process of a panel.
So your time has expired. Let me see if there are any further questions. I'll permit you to briefly conclude.
Your Honor, based off of the evidence heard, the appellant requests that this court provide guidance to the field that prior to closing, specifically 412 hearings, and in light of Waller and RCM 806, that the military judges conduct case-by-case analysis prior to closing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.